I watch an all-white show like Friends, and I'm like, well, that is an exotic show to me. You know what I mean? Like, the idea that white is neutral and Anglo is neutral, I want to question and resist, because for me, the family law, as much as it's new to other people, was my experience.
You don't see yourself on screen. You don't see anyone that's like you on screen.
I've been a terrorist. I've been the student that works in a convenience store.
Acknowledge your own unconscious bias.
We need to make our own content.
Hello and welcome to The Colour Cycle, a podcast that aims to disrupt cultural whitewashing and asks, do our arts and screens look like Australia? I'm Lena Nahlus, the Executive Director of Diversity Arts Australia, or DARTS for short. We advocate for a creative sector that has greater diversity of artists, content and audiences. But firstly, I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land and to pay my respects to their elders past and present. You know, the latest census data tells us what we already know if we walk down the street. 49% of us are either first or second generation migrants. Almost a third of us are from backgrounds where we speak a language other than English. So we're an incredibly culturally diverse nation. But do we see this diversity when we go home and watch TV, or when we go to a theatre or to an art gallery?
The writer Benjamin Law recently put it in this way. He quoted from the Dominican American writer Juno Diaz, who said, and I quote, "There's the idea that monsters, vampires, don't have reflections in a mirror. What I've always thought isn't that monsters don't have reflections in a mirror. It's that if you want to make a human being into a monster, deny them, at the cultural level, any reflection of themselves." As Law reflected, and I quote, "When I first heard that quote, I knew exactly what he meant. Growing up without seeing yourself reflected back in your nation's stories is a quietly dehumanising thing."
That was the Race Discrimination Commissioner, Tim Sutphamasan, speaking at the recent Beyond Tick Boxes symposium at Gasula Powerhouse in Western Sydney. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people over many years and listened to what a lot of other people have had to say, particularly artists and creatives who come from culturally diverse backgrounds. And many of us can't relate to the images, films and arts that are being produced by Australia's cultural institutions and production companies. That's not to say that there's not good work happening or that there's no engagement with diversity. But on the whole, we don't often see our stories or our faces represented. So in this podcast series, we're actually going to be looking at what some of the barriers are to culturally and linguistically diverse artists participating in the arts and cultural sectors and screen sectors in Australia. And as an aside, now's probably a good time to tell you that we are using terms like culturally and linguistically diverse, or CALD for short, terms like non-English speaking background, NES for short, and sometimes people of colour. We recognise that these terms are not without their problems. They're often imposed on people and communities, and they're very othering. We want to talk about this in future episodes, and we plan to do this, so bear with us. We've been everything, haven't we? We've been NES, CALD, which people hate. Like, people really hate it. Each episode, we'll play a round of darts and we'll award 5 sparkly stars to an individual or an institution who's doing great things for cultural diversity in the arts.
Australians love racism.
So in this episode, Creating New Reflections, we're going to meet someone who's literally changing the face of our television screens.
My new pen for the new year, Chinese Year of the Cock.
Rooster Mum.
We definitely celebrated cock.
Benjamin Law is working on the 3rd and final season of The Family Law, an SBS TV series. It's a comedic look at a high school boy's trials and misadventures with his family who are going through a divorce. Oh, and they happen to be Asian.
In the end, family is forever, for better or worse.
Mummy's so proud of my baby boy's big climax.
Benjamin's also taken up a role as one of the critics on the ABC TV's new series about all things film called Screen Time, which, in a nice surprise, has a very diverse panel. He's also the author of The Family Law, Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, and the quarterly essay on the safe schools debate called Moral Panic 101.
My name is Benjamin Law, and this is my family.
Well, I should just say thank you so much, Benjamin Law, for being part of this podcast.
Happy to have a chat.
Yay.
About my favourite topics as well.
So recently we had this symposium called Beyond Tick Boxes, and it was introduced by Tim Sutphamasan, who's the Race Commissioner of the Australian Human Rights Commission, and he actually quoted from you, quoting from the Dominican-American writer
Juno Diaz.
That's right, yes. Yeah. And it was a really powerful quote that actually stayed with me and many people who I've spoken with about how dehumanising and alienating it is to not see yourself reflected on TV.
Mm.
Has that been your experience?
Yeah, that quote, when I heard it, it's kind of been a quote that's been passed around like a happy virus. I first heard it when an Australian writer, C.S. Paquette, who has Italian background, was kind of talking about, you know, not seeing herself as a wog on television much growing up. And this quote by Juno Diaz, who's Dominican-American, talks about there's that idea that there are monsters on TV, like vampires, and they can't see themselves in the reflection. But he always thought that if you want to make people into actual monsters, you deny them at a cultural level any representation of themselves. And growing up, this really resonates with me, the idea that as a child in coastal Queensland, in a very white part of Australia, my access to the outside world or my idea of Australia was through traditional mediums like television and radio and print advertising. And that was wholly white. And because I was growing up in a white part of Australia as well, I had no idea that we are actually, by some measures at least, one of the most diverse nations in the world. And when you've got, like, for instance, I'm Chinese Australian, but when you've got 1 in 10 Australians with significant Asian ancestry, when you've got 1 in 5 Australians able to speak languages other than English at home, 1 in 30 Australians is Indigenous as well. With those kinds of figures, I think like 1 in 2 Australians has at least one parent born overseas or were born overseas themselves. Like that's massive. You know, over 300 separate languages spoken at home. Why don't we see that on television? We might look to certain shows now and say, oh, we're getting diversity now. This has been such a recent phenomenon, and at the same time, it's still really common and really unquestioned to have all Anglo casts on television, whether it's factual or scripted. And that's not just bad for adults, but I really worry about Australian kids who see that stuff as well.
I think that's so true. Like my thing was that with Arab culture, we definitely saw ourselves represented on TV. Mm. We still see ourselves represented on TV a lot in the news segments, the crime segments.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
there's been a terrorist incident.
Yeah, yeah, but not speaking in your own voice on your own terms. And
you're not being at the centre of your story. You're like a subject rather than an actual three-dimensional person.
Was that kind of your experience? You did see Asian characters, but they were often token. So in Home and Away, you saw, you know,
like victim of racial discrimination number 2 or something. Alf Stewart learns his lesson and that character disappears.
and also the Lim family.
Oh, on Neighbours.
On Neighbours, the Hong Kong Chinese family.
And this was as recently as the 1990s. Like, I think it was the mid to late 90s that the Lim family came on. And from what I understand, I don't watch Neighbours now, but from what I understand, Neighbours is much better with cultural diversity in 2017 than it was in the 1990s. But the Lim family were a Hong Kong migrant family. They arrive on Ramsey Street. A dog promptly goes missing and they are accused of barbecuing the neighbourhood dog. And of course, it turns out, it's not the Lim family, but once the residents, the white residents of Ramsey Street learn their lesson that racism is wrong, the Lim family disappear and are never seen or heard from again. Because, you know, that's what happens in real life. People just move into a street, then disappear the next day. It's just hilariously bizarre. You know, it would be so much more interesting to see, well, what is their perspective? They represent a big chunk of your viewing audience, not just as a Chinese Australian family, but as a migrant family on a new street. What does that feel like? I imagine a lot of that story could possibly resonate for people. So what is unintentional comedy is also a missed opportunity.
So is that kind of what motivated you to create your own work? Like why did you create Family Law?
Look, in some ways I'm very conscious of the fact that there is very little Asian Australian representation on television, and certainly that's a motivating fact. But I think you're going to end up with a pretty earnest and unwatchable piece of art if you're saying to yourself, I want to make groundbreaking television, everyone, because, like, who's going to want to watch that? I want to watch the latest series of Survivor. Thank you very much. You know what I mean? So the first part is, yeah, I'm really interested in this stuff. I even wrote a thesis about minority representation on television as well. And, yeah, it does drive me to an extent. But the other way that I'd answer it is that I simply want to write about stories that resonate with me. I want to write about stories that are interesting and human and three-dimensional. And I can't disentangle myself from my race. So, of course, if I'm going to write a family story, it's probably going to be what I know, which is a Chinese-Australian family, migrant family with kids who are second generation as well. For me, that's neutral. For a lot of other people, it would be, wow, that's so different. But for me, you know, I watch an all-white show like Friends, and I'm like, well, that is an exotic show to me. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
The idea that white is neutral and Anglo is neutral, I want to question and resist, because for me, the family law, as much as it's new to other people, was my experience.
So what are the audiences like? Like, you know, who are the audiences for your show?
Yeah.
And do you get a different response from first and second generation people, and not specifically Asian Australian, but just in general?
Well, after the first series came out especially, we were hoping that there'd be a really great response from Asian Australian viewers, simply because we've been deprived of seeing anyone like us on screen for so bloody long. And also keep in mind that, like I said, 1 in 10 Australians has significant Asian background. That's roughly how many Black Americans there are in the States. So 12% of Americans are African American. And when you think of how much Black representation is on American TV, and they're still having the debate that it's still not robust enough, and then you look at how many, you know, yellow and brown faces, Asian descent, there are on Australian TV, we're a long way behind. And so we were really grateful and lucky that that Asian Australian audience were like, wow, that's my family. But what's really heartening beyond that is how many people said, wow, that's my family, who aren't Asian Australian, because for them, the divorce narrative really resonated for them. For them, they came from a big family, or they came from a migrant family. Perhaps they were raised on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. There were all these other ways that the show resonated, and I'm really, really grateful for that, because one of the first lines in the show is a voiceover where Ben says, you know, for the longest time I thought my mum was like this because she's Chinese, but it turns out it's just my mum. And we kind of wanted to signal to the audience very early on that, no, this is going to be about the specifics of this family. It's not going to be just about, oh, they're like this because they're Chinese Australian or whatever.
And I think what is interesting about your show that is a little bit different from other shows that aren't white is that the leadership is not white. So the actual people behind the screen.
Yeah. So Tony Ayres is one of the executive producers, and Debbie Lee is the other executive producer. They both just happen to be Chinese Australian. We refer to them as the Chinese mafia of Australian television. And they're two of the senior producers at Matchbox Pictures, which is the biggest TV production company in Australia right now in terms of output. So they've made everything from The Family Law to big budget productions like Glitch. They make kids TV like Nowhere Boys. They made The Slap. They made Secret City for Foxtel. They make Wanted for Channel 7 with Rebecca Gibney. So these are people who are making a whole lot of shows, but at the core of everything they do, they are interested in telling different original stories. And when we've lived in a country where our basic kind of standard for story is all white cast, they're like, well, that doesn't really represent the Australia that most of us live in and know. And when we talk about diversity, I think sometimes it's framed in this cosmetic feel-good way, like, oh, we should have more people on TV that look like us and won't that be nice? But there's something more fundamental going on here. I think every Australian of any background wants to see their community, their workplaces, their families on screen as well. And when you exclude certain people from screen, because that's what we've been doing for generations now, that is a form of overt kind of structural racism. And I think sometimes we skip around the issue a lot about, like, oh, we should put more non-white faces on screen. It's like, no, the fact that only white faces have been on screen for a long time is prejudiced.
So I guess, you know, you kind of talked about, you know, Tony and Debbie as having these key roles.
Michelle Guthrie as well, head of the ABC, first non-white person.
But my question is, how important is it for that direction? So what I hear a lot from actors or people who are making films and not always just actors, is often the decision-making isn't being made enough by people of colour, and it's being made by white people who have a particular perspective or idea, and they have to, you know, perform the part that doesn't, and they often don't feel that they're in a position where they can talk back or push back. How important is it to have people in those leadership roles, and how do you switch that? Because it is about power, and people don't want to give it up.
Well, it's really important, because we talk about diversity as what we see in front of the screen when we turn on the TV, and they're usually actors and hosts, and those are the kinds of people who have the least say. You know, it's not like they cast themselves into the show. Someone else is making that decision. It's not like they write the characters. So writers, producers, directors, executives, and network executives as well, they're the ones in power. And so I think you've hit upon something really important here, which is when we're talking about diversity and inclusion, it's really about making sure that diversity and inclusion is there on every level of the creative process. And it's not just about plonking a yellow, black or brown face in front of the television. You're more likely to have a richer representation if you actually do have someone from that background in the writer's room. And it's not necessarily about, like, let's get rid of all the white people in power, but it's about those people in power. If they want diversity, the second part of the conversation, and they do, they've said this at conferences, we want more diversity on screen, blah, 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 blah. If you do, what are you going to do about it? And the fact is, you can't keep doing what you've already been doing, because that's been proven for many, many years now that that doesn't work. So what are you going to do? Are you going to introduce more non-white people into the writer's room? Are you going to hire interns from different backgrounds? Are you going to specify to the people who do hire underneath you that you want diversity? And do you, I mean, when you talk about beyond ticking a box, I think at the very in the first instance, maybe you should be looking at what those boxes are, because I think a lot of people don't even know what those boxes are before they even start thinking about ticking them or getting anxious about ticking them. You know, being explicit about what you want to do and how you want to go about it.
I like that. Thank you. I've just got a whole heap of strategies there that, that we'll totally use. Often people say we can't find people. Mm. And then my answer is, well, if you really can't find people, and often I find that hard to believe, then train people. You've said in one of your interviews that I think something to the effect of that you thought that it was going to be, you know,
impossible,
difficult to cast at 80% kind of Asian cast.
Mm.
And then you advertised kind of internationally, but as it turned out, that most of those characters were local characters.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we were writing The Family Law, you don't want to hurdle ahead to production realities, because that can freak you out with the writing process. And it's like, this is too hard. Let's just make them all white, because we won't be able to find all of these Chinese Australian actors. And there were really specific requirements as well. So not only did they have to be bloody good actors, especially the parents, but the mum and the dad both needed to have some sort of proficiency with Cantonese as well. And that ruled out a lot of people immediately. When we were thinking about casting, even before we even started, we were like, who can we even think of who are prominent Asian Australian actors? And besides Anthony Wong, who plays Danny, you know, we could probably count them on our hands, and that's really problematic when you go into casting as well. And so the casting agents, the director and our producers, when they started the casting process, all of them agree that it was probably the most difficult casting process of their entire careers. And like you said, Lena, the call went out internationally. I think it went to Singapore, New Zealand, the UK, the US, Canada. And even though it went international and it went to places that were non-traditional, like schools and social groups and Chinese language newspapers and stuff like that, what we did find eventually was that, one, yeah, most of our talent was already in Australia. And two, a lot of them already had acting experience as well. The only person who was overseas was Fee Choi, the mum, who was based in New York. And she is Australian as well. The main reason, well, one of the reasons she's living there is, one, she was raising a family in the States. And two, she had to be in the States in order to get work, because there's just simply not enough work in Australia. And I guess that case study shows us that when you make that excuse that I can't find the people, I would probably call bullshit on that. It means that you're probably not trying hard enough. Yes, the process will be harder, but you need to have the willpower to make the extra effort as well. And also, you know, once you open up your organization or your production company or your show to other people, that is helping and encouraging other people from those backgrounds to get into the industry as well. For instance, Tristan, who plays Benjamin in The Family Law, he's like a lead actor on a TV show now. He didn't have any screen credits before this, but he had a lot of stage credits as well. So he did have acting experience and background, but it's just the fact that there weren't any screen roles to give him an opportunity.
And then, as you were kind of saying earlier, Benjamin, when people see themselves on screen, kind of becomes a possibility
that absolutely. They
could then be that person on screen.
And conversely, if you say we can't cast people and we would love to have like a Lebanese person on the screen but we can't find them or whatever, and then you don't put them on screen, and there is a big history. I mean, I've even worked kind of on productions where it's like, oh, and this person's going to have, you know, a South Asian background, and then that you watch the show and they're white. Like, that happens a lot. You need to realize that it's going to take more time, so you should start the casting process early. And also, if you keep making that practice happen, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, we can't find the people, we're going to have to put a white person there. You're never going to find those people because you're not implementing any change.
So people really resist quotas. I think that they're not the ultimate answer, but I think we need them and that we inadvertently have them. And the quota system defaults to kind of Anglo-Celtic people, and it's just unstated. We're not actually being honest about it. What do you think about kind of quotas?
So like you, I think quotas only exist because unfortunately they're required. Do you know what I mean? So for a really long time, workplaces, businesses, the media, the arts has been skewered towards white men, white heterosexual able-bodied men. And I don't think that – I mean, I think a lot of people get really confronted when I point that out, but I don't think it's an especially controversial statement either because it's kind of bloody obvious. And so when you introduce quotas, it's a mechanism to address long-standing, you know, structures to do with sexism and racism that has afforded white men to help each other climb the ladder at work. I think why people are really resistant to quotas is this idea that because we live in a meritocracy, these people are going to just zoom in into their jobs without a trace of merit themselves. And I'm like, that sounds right, but it isn't. Because if you're saying that a meritocracy exists, you're also by default saying that white able-bodied heterosexual men are more qualified for the job than anyone else, because that's the reality that they take up most of the space. Why I think quotas are important is to address the fact that if anyone's given an unfair advantage, it's mediocre white men who dominate. And look, I know that sounds really glib, but in fact, the studies actually confirm it. Like, for instance, the Australian National University has an ongoing survey that they update every year. And what it shows is that if you have a conspicuously Asian background name, if you have a conspicuously Indigenous sounding name, if you have a conspicuously Middle Eastern sounding name, and you make fake resumes and you send them out for entry level jobs, and all of these resumes have pretty much exactly the same qualifications for this job, that the people who have Anglo sounding names will be preferenced by a very, very significant margin. And when that evidence exists, that we prefer Anglo people to work at our jobs, when we prefer men, when we prefer all these other markers, we need some sort of mechanism to address that. But I think the biggest kind of discussion we need to have is whether we exist in a meritocracy or not. And I would say no, because so many people with talent are constantly overlooked in favor of what I would say is mediocre white men.
Yeah. I agree. But in terms of kind of younger people who are trying to get into the industry, who want to be screenwriters or, you know, directors or producers, who are not from Anglo-Saxon backgrounds, who are not from privileged backgrounds necessarily either, is there advice that you would give them? You know, because I know when I talk to a lot of younger people, they do get quite disheartened, where they feel quite, this is not for me. This is such a hard industry to be in. The only way I can be in this industry is to not be who I am.
Find a community, form a triad. I mean, if people are worried about you taking over their jobs, do it. Find the other people. If you're finding it difficult to break into an industry because you just see a phalanx of, you know, white people and you feel quite excluded from that community, there are definitely other people in the country who feel similarly as well, who are trying to break in the same way. So find those people. Like, for instance, on Facebook, I'm a part of like a private group that's all just people of color writers from Australia as well. And we share information and resources. When one of us knows there's a job going, or if we're in charge of hiring, we're like, hey guys, I would love to see your applications in there. Let's elevate each other. If for a long time we've been excluded from the conversation because it's a white dude's club, then let's make our own clubs as well. And I think that's a completely legitimate strategy. And if that strikes fear in the heart of other people, good.
So our own infrastructure, like building your own kind of structures to support each other and yeah.
People are so afraid of us taking over, and I'm just like, I can't wait.
World domination. Thank you very much for joining us, Benjamin Law. You are an amazing creator and you inspire me.
Oh, thanks, Lena. Thank you very much. That was fun.
That was author and screenwriter Benjamin Law. For more information about his work, go to benjamin-law.com. And now for a quick round of darts. In this regular segment, we'll hear the voice of Sonia Mermand from Diversity Arts Australia asking someone three very quick questions, and we'll see if their answers hit the dartboard.
Bali Patta, and I am an actor, producer and diversity advocate, and I'm the chair of the Equity Diversity Committee at the Media Entertainment Arts Alliance.
And apologies for the noisy sound quality. We caught Bali at the Beyond Tick Boxes Symposium. It sounded like a real round of darts at the pub.
What have been the biggest barriers you faced in your career?
When I decided to become an actor in my early 20s, I quit my IT career. Surprise, surprise. And I looked at Australian TV and I was like, well, I've got no luck here. So I did move to the UK to start performing, and it was really great. But then I was forced to move back home, GFC, everything, all of that. You know, I've been fetishized as a person of Indian heritage for stage and screen. I've been a terrorist. I've been the student that works in a convenience store. Very rarely have I ever been someone that I feel like I closely represent, which is an Australian-born dude who goes to the beach, who hosts barbecues, does all the things that we'd say is Australian culture in our mainstream, but yet I still have to represent an other.
What needs to change to increase diversity?
I think it's the change is already happening with, you know, the changes of guidelines and processes for some of the funding bodies at the moment. I think more change needs to happen. I think also organisations, peak organisations, agencies, major companies and organisations, institutions need to start embedding diversity in their actual organisations. So until you hire someone with a wheelchair, do you then realise that your building is inaccessible? So until you hire someone of a cultural diversity that doesn't exist currently in your organisation, will you ever or never represent or address that? So it's time now that those organisations start embedding that into their systems.
What does the future look like?
I think the future is positive. I think the future is scary for some people as well. The future is uncertain, but I think we're on the right track. Momentum has changed. This conversation has been happening for 30 plus years, and we can't deny that people have been having that conversation for such a long time. Fortunately, with the advent of social media and far-reaching communication, that the conversation is louder and reaching more people. There are more voices in it. And so it hit that tipping point within the last couple of years, so that now if you're whitewashing, if you're not being accurate in your representation, if you're just showing one view, then that's not okay. And people are willing to call that out. So that's really great. And I'm looking forward to us not needing to call that out anymore. And I'm looking forward to the system being flooded with new diverse practitioners and storytellers and stories as well.
And now for our Sparkly 5-Star Awards. Each episode of our podcast will be awarding 5 stars to an individual, arts organisation, cultural institution, screen company, or artist that's doing something exemplary to promote cultural diversity in the arts. And the winner is... the New South Wales Writers' Centre and Bankstown Arts Centre for putting on the Boundless Writers' Festival, the first ever festival focused on Indigenous and culturally diverse Australian writers and writing. It was a great event, and throughout this podcast we'll hear some of the writers appearing in our darts game. If you want to nominate someone for a gold star,
send your recommendations to info@diversityarts.org.au or leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's been episode one of the Colour Cycle podcast, brought to you by Diversity Arts Australia. Subscribe wherever you download your favourite podcasts or listen back via our website, diversityarts.org.au, where you can find lots more information about our work and our social media handles. Rate us on iTunes. It really helps other people find the podcast. We'd love to hear your comments. Record your voice on your phone and email it to us at info@diversityarts.org.au. That's info@diversityarts.org.au. We hadn't even put the podcast out yet, only the trailer, and we were already getting great feedback via Facebook and Twitter. I wanted to share with you one of the tweets that we got from Anna Tawiri. So I'm going to get our podcast producer, Jennifer Macy, to read it to you. So over to you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Alina, and thanks, Anna, for this comment. She writes, "Congratulations and many, many thanks for starting this wonderful podcast. I just heard the intro piece and love it. This is very exciting. I just wanted to express my gratitude. Looking forward to listening to the podcast regularly. Very clever title too. Love it."
This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy from Audiocraft. Thank you to Tarek Sawires for composing our intro and outro music, and to Terumi Narashima and Paul Macy for additional music. Thanks so much to Create New South Wales and the Australia Council for their generous support in producing this podcast series, and to Casula Powerhouse Arts Centre. I'm Lena Nahluis. Thanks for your time, and yalla goodbye.